Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So in the most disconcerting and unfamiliar of years, the Grand Slam season has ended with the most familiar and predictable sight in all of tennis. Rafael Nadal lifting aloft the Coupe de Mousquetaire on the Philippe Chatrier court. His 13th Roland Garros title, his record-equalling 20th Grand Slam title overall. And of course, the way he did it, the nature of the final was anything but predictable. But I've got David and Matt right here, ready and raring to go to discuss, digest, reflect on all of that in just a few moments. But I hope you'll allow me just a moment of indulgence first, because this is our last daily podcast of 2020. I hope you've enjoyed all these 15 daily French Open pods. Hope you've enjoyed all of our daily and weekly pods so far this year. It's 125 and counting, which is fairly ridiculous. That is 25% more matches than Rafael Nadal has won at Roland Garros. I'm not saying all of this because it's the end. We've got plenty more pods to come. And David now has a full week off to start having ideas in the middle of the night. I'm saying this because in about 6 weeks' time, we'll be launching our Kickstarter campaign to crowdfund the podcast for 2021. We'll launch it on December the 1st. And continuing the podcast and continuing it to the standard we've achieved this year, predictions aside, is something that's very, very important to us. If we could do it without asking for money, we would. We love the podcast and the three of us are completely devoted to it, but it does cost money, even when we're not traveling. I'm sure all of you would agree that it is inconceivable to think of this podcast without Matt. I can't quite believe David and I ever did it for all those years without Matt, frankly. He's completely invaluable. And of course, Matt comes with the odd caravan. Also essential. And then there's the fumigators to get rid of the insects that he finds in his in his bedroom in the middle of the night. So none of that comes cheap. We've got editors, a completely devoted, amazing team of editors, in particular Patrick, who's done these past couple of weeks at the French Open. Hello, Patrick. Thank you for everything. We've got our designer, Gorana, who does just incredible work across all of our merchandise. She works on the newsletter. We've got Sarah, our fixer and sort of does everything, anything we can think of. Sarah says, oh, I can help with that. It's a whole team of people and they all make a contribution, and it's hard to imagine doing it without them. I know it's a tough time financially for a lot of people out there. We're really conscious of that. And if you're not able to contribute this year, we really do understand. But if you can support the podcast, we hope you do. Because we want to continue this thing. We want to do more. We want to deliver more. We want to do even more. bad predictions. And if you'll allow me just one final bit of indulgence, I'm going to read out just a couple of lines from an email we received from Steve, Cam's dad, today. We actually received it just a few games before the end of the men's final, and it distracted me to the extent that I couldn't quite pay attention to the final couple of games. I'm hoping David and Matt got a grasp on how the match ended, but here's a couple of lines from this wonderful email from Steve. He said, "Sharing Cam with all of you has been such a privilege. I'm sure everyone feels their dog would be beloved if only other people knew him or her. Joe and I have always felt that about Cam, and now we've actually gotten to experience it. The love and support from the Tennis Podcast audience, the comments on YouTube and on Twitter have been such a boost to our spirits. Knowing that if we lost him, and we nearly did, Cam would have so many new friends mourning his passing was like some kind of magic, some miracle anti-sadness pill. But of course, it's not magic. It's good old-fashioned humanity, and it's reflective of the warmth and friendship we hear every time we listen to the Tennis Podcast." I'm not just reading that to big us up. I'm reading it because it kind of reflects, I think, how we feel about the podcast. It's certainly how I feel about the podcast, about David and Matt, and about the whole podcast community. It is a miracle anti-sadness pill and a cloak of warmth and friendship and purpose in what has been a very cold year. So we'll be launching the Kickstarter on December the 1st, and I hope you can support us if you can. David, Matt.
Oh, dear. I'm not sure I can talk at the moment.
Can you imagine how Rafael Nadal feels about now?
Yeah, just as well. I mean, wonderfully well said. And what a beautiful letter that was that Steve sent. I mean, it did choke us all a little bit.
David had to go on the radio afterwards.
I did. I had to pretend that I hadn't read it. But anyway, what we do is, as Catherine says, we launch this thing on the 1st of December, and we've got an email list that we send one email a year out to on December the 1st, just to let everybody know it's live. And the link to that's in the show notes if you want to be on it. Should we talk about tennis? Should we talk about this final?
I'm putting off having to actually sum up the achievement of Rafael Nadal winning 13 French Opens and winning this French Open in particular and doing it in the way that he did, because it's so astonishing. I'm struggling to process, frankly.
Yes, apologies in advance for hyperbole and use of superlatives, but if you can't use them now, when Rafael Nadal is now 102 at Roland Garros and has won his 13th title, when can you use them? It is utterly extraordinary what he's achieved today. And also, of course, this is an achievement that is actually 15, 16 years in the making. It is unbelievable what Nadal is able to do, both in tennis, number one, but also just at this tournament.
One of his best ever career performances, David, today?
I would say so. This was up there with what he did to Federer in 2008, when Federer won a handful of games. Arguably even better, I think, because Federer struggled that day. I think that the conditions were less suited to him today, on paper at least, I would have thought, compared to a high bouncing hot day in June. And of course, he's 12 years older. I mean, let's not forget he's 34. That shouldn't be put to one side, because, you know, he's got a lot of miles in those legs, a lot of kilometres. And it's just mind-boggling that he can physically do it for a start. I think it bore a lot of similarities to what Djokovic did to him in the Australian Open final of 20 months ago, which Djokovic referenced Nadal referenced in his post-match comments. It had that same feel. In as much as when we were discussing this yesterday and we were building up to it all week long, the one eventuality I could not see is one of these destroying the other one. That I just could not see. I mean, which is, again, just another example of how good at predictions I am. But it was a performance that I wasn't expecting of that level. And that feels unfair to Rafael Nadal after what he's done over the last 12 years. But he lifted himself to a level we certainly haven't seen at this tournament.
Mm. And
this fortnight, anyway, you know,
it wasn't just fortunate that Nadal woke up and happened to be having a brilliant day today. It wasn't just one of those things. The way the cookie crumbles, he changed things in his approach today. He was, and I believe the stats ended up bearing this out in terms of Naomi Brody was quoting it on your coverage, David, about the net clearance on his backhand being significantly lower today than in previous matches, indicating how much more aggressive he was being on that. I mean, I think on both wings, but in particular on that backhand side, he was firmly the aggressor out there, and Djokovic was on the back foot right from the word go, and he looked bewildered by the level throughout. Imagine playing really good tennis and being the world number one and having lost a set 6-love. I can't imagine how awful that feels. You know, I texted you guys at the end of that first set and I said, other than serving a bit better, I don't know what he can do. I don't think it's a question of, just raise your level a bit and that'll be okay. What can he possibly do?
Yeah, and he's been in his press conference, Djokovic, and used the word surprised by Nadal's level. I don't think he saw this coming from Nadal based on what we've seen from Nadal these 2 weeks. Yes, Nadal's been great. He's got to the final without dropping a set, but he's clearly not been absolutely top level Nadal. And I'm not sure Djokovic was expecting the performance that we saw from Nadal today. He was caught a bit off guard, surprised, bewildered. And that is so much credit, as you said, to what Nadal was doing. He was the aggressor. He was taking every opportunity to hit his forehand down the line and standing up on the baseline and kind of taking the drop shot away from Djokovic. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about that, but just little subtle changes in his game that he made that just made this huge overall difference. And with the intent that he played with, it was overwhelming for Novak Djokovic. And I was kind of reminded of a little quote I read from Tony Nadal recently, who, after the Schwartzman team match, said, "A lot of people compare team to my nephew, but I don't think that's a fair comparison." This was in Spanish. This was in the Spanish newspaper El País. And he was saying that team is a great player, but he doesn't have the options in his game that Nadal has and the different ways to be able to beat you. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about on a podcast recently, where, David, you said the fact that these players are always adding things to their game, Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer. And Nadal has got so many different ways he can beat you. He can change up what he does. And he did that today. And I think it surprised Djokovic. And it shouldn't be surprising to me and to us, but it kind of was surprising to see Nadal change tactically against Djokovic. That rivalry has been so familiar in my head of what that looks like in terms of the patterns of the rallies. And this one was different out there. Nadal's tactical awareness today was as good as anything I've ever seen from him, I think.
I remember a moment, it was in the second set because you were commentating, David. I think towards the end of the second set, it felt like it was quite deep into the match. And Nadal served volleyed for the first time.
Yeah.
And Leon Smith remarked upon it. And at that point, it felt like, he can do that as well.
Yeah.
He hadn't even needed to use that trick. But, reminding you, here it is.
When I got onto the commentary set that I was doing, which was set number two, I was trying to work out what's happening. Because whilst the ball was zipping back and forth and hitting winners for Nadal, he'd also got a very clearly defined tactic that I also thought he used against Schwartzman of hitting his own backhand down the line with loop and topspin very deep onto the Djokovic backhand. And I don't think I expected to see that at all. I just wasn't expecting that shot. You know, we've always seen the cross court forehand from him do that, but this was, I mean, he was almost hitting lobs, but viciously, powerfully, and topspun. And Djokovic was trying to half volley them the way only he can, but they were proving too much even for him. But when I got onto my set that I was doing, that's when I noticed that court positioning. It was like watching Nadal at times on a hard court. The way he was almost like saying, right, now I'm going to get onto the, I've returned it, now I'm getting on the baseline, and you're going to have it. You know, he was crowding the court. It was, and I thought, when we talk about how these players are developing tactics all the time as they're getting older and ways to beat each other, look at the way Federer developed that backhand whip against Nadal to turn that rivalry around. Here, everybody, writers, us, everybody is talking about how the drop shot is going to be the new tactic against Nadal by Djokovic. And that, you know, you remarked on earlier in the day, Catherine, about how it was like Djokovic had spent the whole tournament preparing himself for this moment to play against Nadal, who's going to have his back against the fence and he's going to be burning him with drop shots. And I was fully expecting that that would be the tactic that we were talking about today in a positive sense for Novak Djokovic. It felt like, I don't know this for sure, but it felt like Nadal knew that was coming and said, okay, right, I know you're going to do that. I'm going to be on the baseline and I will diffuse those drop shots, because that's what he did for the whole match. I mean, Nadal's got wonderful hands for a start. When he's rushing forwards, playing those little dink rallies, I don't think there's anybody better than him at that. And the moment you get the ball up in the air against him, he's probably got the most powerful overhead backhand, you know, backhand smash. And he's also got the skyhook forehand smash so that he can rush back and hit it powerfully way further back in the court than anybody else can, even though he's not the tallest. So he just completely diffused Djokovic's strategy with his own strategy. And I really enjoy watching that.
I must say, I wasn't ever convinced that a drop shot was going to be a great tactic against Nadal. I know he's not got a brilliant record against Nadal at Roland Garros, and so I think it's to his credit that he was thinking of ways that he could maybe change the pattern of that match. But he has got a good record in the rivalry generally against Nadal, and he's very comfortable in the rallies normally. He's the one dictating, and he can manhandle Nadal when he's playing well, even on a clay court. And I just think, if I was Nadal, as soon as Djokovic plays four drop shots in the very first game of the match, I thought that was an immediate boost for Nadal, because I'm thinking, well, it almost feels a bit of a panic already, as though he can't live with me in the rallies. So he's having to revert to this drop shot. And because Nadal is so fast, and because he's got those amazing hands that you said, that you referenced, David, Djokovic was having to play absolutely perfect drop shots. And it meant that he was missing quite a lot of them into the net. It was a real problem for him today, whether to use the drop shot or not. I think his success rate through the tournament was about 80% with the drop shots, and it dropped to less than 50% today against Nadal. A huge, huge switch in its effectiveness. And as much as Nadal contributed to that with his tactical positioning and changing where he was in the court, I was surprised Djokovic didn't abandon it more quickly than he did. He seemed to abandon it in that third set, and that was when the rallies started resembling the ones I'm a bit more used to. But by that point, Nadal's lead was so great and Djokovic wasn't quite playing his best. He was making more unforced errors than we're used to seeing from him, and kind of felt like the match had pretty much gone at that point with Nadal playing so well. And yeah, it was fascinating tactically from both sides of the net, therefore.
He was desperate in that third set, wasn't he? I mean, I think he was desperate by the second set, really. And actually, yes, there was a period when that desperation kind of manifested itself in him just hitting out, and it coincided with Nadal nearing the finish line and obviously getting a bit tight given what was on the line. And it did feel for a moment like, oh, they're all that there could well be a full set here. I'm sure, David, you were stretching and lunging and limbering up for a fourth set of commentary. But it was kind of the flailing movements of utter desperation at what to do in the face of this total onslaught today. I know the unforced errors did start mounting in the third set, but it felt to me like, when is an unforced error not an unforced error? I'm not sure he hit any unforced errors today, because Nadal forced all of them.
We had the stats on Nadal's unforced errors that I think until 6-love 5-1, Nadal had hit 3 unforced errors in basically 2 sets. And then he had a flurry of them right at the end of the second set. I think I remarked to you both that I think he's just slightly losing his timing a little bit. And I wondered whether he was just getting a little nervous, to be honest, closing in on the second set. He was sort of grunting and leaving the ball a bit shorter and things like that. And he just wasn't quite as convincing. I think there was a double fault in there. He lost his second game of the match. I mean, at the end of the second set, his game, Djokovic doubled his game tally, I mean, to get to 2. And then when they went into the third set, it was parity, really, throughout most of that. There was an early break for Nadal. When Djokovic hit back and unleashed that roar, I did think we were going to get a long match at that point, because Djokovic, he just let it go. He started to really let his arm go, and he was starting to hurt Nadal at times, which was fantastic. That was when the match was just boiling, and at that moment, I did think of the Medvedev final against the US Open last year, because Nadal wasn't quite as good in that as he was here, but he was comfortably in charge of that final against Medvedev, and he was a breakup in that as well. And then it just became that nerve-wracking epic. And, well, he just didn't allow that today. I mean, I don't know. One of the absolute greatest performances of his life.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm slightly distracted, David, by it. The fact that it now looks like you're sort of featuring in a scene from the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, it's great in the studio. I mean, I'm in the BBC studio at the moment, and we do go from day into night whilst we're commentating. We've got the screens in front of us, and we've got this massive expanse of the quay and the horizon with a lovely sunset at the moment. But we started this podcast in the light, and we're 20 minutes in, and it's already dark. So yeah, it feels like you're commentating in a cinema when we do the night sessions, which is quite a good laugh.
But I can see, but there's a curtain. That's what, yeah. Okay.
I'm opening it. It's a bit hard to do when you're doing a podcast.
Right.
There you go. That's daylight.
Somewhat less spooky.
I don't understand how it's changed to the dark, yeah, so if it's still light outside. What changed in the room for that to happen?
We've only been recording 20 minutes, David.
That's called lens exposure, I think, Matt. I think I just need to face the light.
It suddenly got very eerie very quickly, though, about 2.5 minutes ago.
It's going to get worse.
Okay.
That's what happened.
Right, we'll prepare ourselves for that.
Something that we haven't talked about yet is that this final was under the roof. And I mean, as soon as I saw that it was going to be an indoor final, I thought that tipped the balance more in favour of Novak Djokovic, which I think just makes the performance that Nadal put in even more remarkable. As the match went on, I started, obviously, because what we were witnessing was Nadal dominating, I started to think about whether actually the conditions were favouring Nadal. And I certainly think had it been outdoors, the balls might have got damp and heavy, and those conditions definitely would have favoured Djokovic. And I was reminded of how good Nadal was indoors in Madrid at the Davis Cup finals last year, which to my mind is still one of his greatest feats, what he did.
That was hard court, wasn't it?
It was a hard court. Yeah, and you then put a clay court underneath, and obviously it just makes him even better. But there is this, obviously, narrative around Nadal that he's not great indoors. I think he's only ever won one title indoors, but I think a lot of that is because it comes at the end of the season and he's normally knackered. And here he was fresh and his shots were having so much impact. And I think because the court was generally slow, because it's a clay court, Novak Djokovic taking the ball early didn't seem to be having that much effect, because he wasn't rushing Nadal in the way that he sometimes does. And yeah, I think Djokovic thought the conditions would suit him as well. That's another thing he said in his press conference. Just maybe another reason why he was surprised and caught off guard at the start of the match. I think he thought things were going to be in his favour, and very quickly, well, not that quickly, but pretty quickly, he found himself a double breakdown. And he never properly settled. There was 2 or 3 games, as you've mentioned, in that third set, but I never really saw the Novak Djokovic I expected to see. And I don't know, to zoom out a little bit, That's three Grand Slam finals now in a row where I don't think Djokovic has played close to his best. He's won two of them, the Wimbledon final against Federer and the team Australian Open final this year. But he was very match aware in those finals, and he won them by being better in the big moments. But I don't know, ever since that 2019 Australian Open final that we've referenced, he's slightly struggled to find his best tennis in Grand Slam finals, I think. And this was probably the most obvious one of the lot.
He's already been into press, hasn't he? And Matt, you caught the end of that press conference. He came in very quickly. And it sounds like it was just all about Nadal. He was just kind of deflecting all questions about himself onto sort of the brilliance of Nadal today, which is completely valid. He's doesn't sound like he's doing much introspection about what he could have done differently. And that's more the side of things I fall onto too, really. I think it does end up looking like a bad performance when you're faced with an opponent playing like that, because you've got to try stuff. You've got to start hitting the panic button and doing things that are outside of your comfort zone, and that can lead to sort of some quite troubling looking sort of unforced error statistics and so on.
There was one giveaway moment in his own speech, though, when he was again fulsome in his praise for Nadal, but he also said, "Wasn't my best performance," he said, and you could see the frustration in him at that point. And I found that really interesting, because having watched it, yes, I mean, look, his first serve percentage in that first set was appalling, really. It was about 30%. And you just can't do that at this level. He raised that very quickly in the second set, and he got it up. But, you know, he's putting himself on the back foot by not... Because usually his first serve is... And his serving generally these days is so difficult to attack. And he was making himself a little more attackable by not making that first serve. But I think that told you that... And I think it's something with these guys. They're that good. They think they should be able to do something about this, even when their opponent is playing that well. And I think it will frustrate him, even though he knows Nadal was amazing.
Matt said, I think it was actually at 4-love in the first set, but it felt like it had been an extraordinarily competitive 4-love. I think all of those games had gone to juice or at least 30. You said, I'm watching this, cutting the next gen that we're not calling the next gen anymore, quite a bit of slack, because you watch something like this and you realise, well, of course they haven't broken through. How could anyone break through into this realm? It's a realm of gods.
They're still so much better. I mean, you watch those first... That first set, and I think particularly the first set, I mean, the highest quality six love set you will ever see, both sides of the net, the angles they were coming up with, the ferocity with which they were hitting the ball, the accuracy, the way their movements are synced up with the way they hit the ball and the patterns of play, it just took my breath away. And I think there's such a frustration, which I so often feel when the next gen that aren't the next gen anymore can't quite break through. And I think it's maybe natural to feel that frustration. But when you do watch these guys play at this level, as I said, it just makes you realise that it's probable that they will never reach this level, because this is a level that men's tennis has never really seen before and might not ever see again. So the required level to win Grand Slam tournaments will probably dip. I mean, we saw that in the US Open final. It was an entertaining, dramatic match, but quality-wise, it was a world away from what we saw from Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal today. And that's okay, you know, that's fine. But I think it's also just worth mentioning again and again just how good these guys are.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, if we go back in history, there are people that have produced this sort of level, Rod Laver, in their own way, Pete Sampras, but they haven't done it over this length of period to accumulate this number of titles. And the thing is, the main thing is, they're just not getting worse, because all of our established understandings of how tennis careers go had these guys becoming much lesser forces when they're in the late 20s. And I mean, look, you know, I think I did my first, I wonder how much longer Roger Federer's got left, 13 years ago, and he's still intending to play next season. And, you know, so, but that's because everything we'd established over the years of what happens when Pete Sampras got to such and such age, he retires. And these guys are just not getting worse. That's what I can't understand. And it's because of their tactical development, so I find them probably more interesting than ever.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We've barely even mentioned the fact that Rafael Nadal is now the joint all-time Grand Slam men's record holder on 20, tied with Roger Federer. If you think back to when Roger Federer tied Pete Sampras's record and what of 14, and how completely momentous that was, and how that was the one and only storyline that day. I mean, I know it's different because they're both active players, but this is completely momentous.
He's playing it down, though, isn't he? That's the other thing with Nadal.
Well,
it's
he's always been the one of the three that's been least obsessed by those numbers. That doesn't mean he doesn't care about them. Of course he does, but he's the least fixated on them. If there were anybody questioning our assumption that Roger Federer would have been supporting Nadal today, here is a tweet by Roger Federer, which came out so soon after Nadal's victory that I wonder at what stage this was composed, whether it was in notes.
If you look at it, it's clearly in notes. He's been penning it halfway through the final or before, you're right.
He said, "I have always had the utmost respect for my friend Rafa as a person and as a champion. As my greatest rival over many years, I believe we have pushed each other to become better players. Therefore, it is a true honour for me to congratulate him on his 20th Grand Slam victory. It is especially amazing that he has now won Roland Garros an incredible 13 times, which is one of the greatest achievements in sport. I also congratulate his team, because nobody can do this alone. I hope 20 is just another step on the continuing journey for both of us." I bet you do, Rog. "Well done, Rafa. You deserve it." Aww.
It's really quite something, isn't it? I think it's lovely how they are about each other, given what they're competing for. And I do look at them a little bit like that London Marathon scene I saw many, many years ago when I was a kid, of two runners who just crossed the line hand in hand together, deliberately, because they didn't want either of them to win. And I know that these guys do want to beat each other. I know they do. They want to be the one. But equally, those two, I genuinely believe that when all is said and done, they'll be content either way.
Well, that's like Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. Chris Evert said, I'm glad we finished on 18 slams each. And it kind of feels like maybe Federer and Nadal, maybe not as close as Chris Evert, Martina Navratilova are as a friendship or as people, but in tennis terms, it does kind of feel like they've been so bonded together that it feels right now that they're both on the same. It's very likely that in May, June next year, Rafael Nadal will win another French Open and have the same number of French Opens as Pete Sampras had Grand Slam titles.
Oh, my word.
He could win two in a year.
I'd not thought of it like that.
For Federer, like, it's all very well and fun now that you're in the same gang, but it could feel really different when Nadal gets his new little gang of one, being the all-time leader. I seeing that message and kind of the whole reaction to Nadal's win and equaling that record, it does make me feel a bit for Novak Djokovic, because even on the day that was supposed to be about Djokovic and Nadal, their 56th meeting in the most prolific rivalry in men's tennis, it still ended up being about Nadal and Federer. He was still the third wheel, even on a day when Federer wasn't blooming playing.
And Federer didn't mention him in the note, which must admit, I did look down that, and I thought, oh, no, can't see that. wonder, maybe that's just an oversight. But, I thought he might have done, just to say unlucky, but there we are. Look, I don't think that'll stop Novak Djokovic from adding to his total for a minute. I think he is coming for more, and he will get more. I really enjoyed listening to Nadal after the match, and he was talking about he wouldn't have this talk of 20. He wanted to concentrate on winning Roland Garros, not for a 13th time, just winning it outright, holding that trophy. That's why he's so great, is because he thinks like that. His mind is not going to places other than this right here, right now. And that's what accumulates all these titles for him, aside, along with obviously his incredible physicality and his skill. But it goes back to something I read in preparation for the final today, when I got Matt to read out the name of a Spanish newspaper several times for me because I didn't know how to pronounce it and I wanted to see if I could get it right. Let me have a go. It was La Voz de Galicia.
Nailed it.
Is that
David.
Right, Matt? Excellent. Right. Now, in this newspaper, back in May, Nadal had said, "It doesn't obsess me, nor is it a great goal for me. I am only concerned about my own career and life. I'm not worried if the one who lives next to me has a bigger house than mine, has a better car, or earns more per month than I do. If they do, they're doing all right." He added, "One has to be satisfied with what one does. And this is what I have done throughout my career, and I'm very satisfied for that. Even if Federer or Djokovic finishes with more Grand Slams than me, it won't affect my happiness 10 years from now."
And it will be really ironic if he ends up with the most, won't it? Given he's the one that wants it the least.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think he does want it, but I just think he's
motivated by it the least.
Yeah, yeah. That end goal is not what's making him play. He loves competition, and he wants to wring out whatever drop of ability he has to compete at the highest level out of his system. I think Federer has that in his own way as well. I think he enjoys tennis in a different way to how Nadal enjoys it. But, I mean, I loved reading that. Even though sometimes they may not make for the greatest soundbite in the world to be talking about the bigger picture, he won't have that. But in his own way there, he's given me some insight that I don't have, or that wouldn't just tripping off the tongue any old soundbite wouldn't give me. It's really something to listen to.
And I also think Nadal, all throughout this pandemic, has had a real perspective on tennis's place, sport's place, kind of in the world at the moment. And I think you kind of saw that in his reaction at the end. It wasn't a typical Nadal wins Roland Garros reaction. For example, we didn't see him on the clay with his racket flung miles away, like we've seen, I think, 12 times before. Pretty much every time he's won it, he's done the same thing. yes, he slightly fell to his knees. And yes, he obviously got teared up when the national anthem was playing. But he also said, in a way, it's a bit sad.
Yeah. Well, after his first round match, he said, the feeling is more sad than usual. Maybe that's what it needs to feel like. It needs to be sad. Many people in the world are suffering.
Mm. Yeah, and I just think he's been able to meet the moment in that sense and keep it in perspective. And yes, it obviously means a huge amount to him to win Roland Garros for another time and to equal the Grand Slam record that Federer's got and all these things. But Nadal also knows that there are more important things. And I think that really does help him. And it's just really showed in everything he's said and the way he's acted this whole tournament, I think.
Mm. Is this his greatest Roland Garros? The fact that it was in October, the roof was on, the balls were changed. He did not have the ideal preparation whatsoever. It made me think of the stone soup story that my dad always used to tell me when I was a kid. Both of you were giving me blank faces. You know the stone soup story?
Go on.
I don't.
I think it's an allegory
but
or something
I'm ready
like
to be
that.
Enlightened.
Oh, it's not that exciting. But it's a woman is, no, a homeless man shows up. I'm sure it was told in sort of oldie worldy language, sort of something, some sort of more mystical term for a homeless man. But anyway, a homeless man shows up on an old lady's doorstep and says, I'll make you dinner if you give me board for the night. And she says, okay. He says, yeah, I can make this lovely soup just from this stone, just from this stone here, the most delicious soup you'll ever taste. And he goes over to the stove and he puts the stone in the pan with a load of water and goes, yeah, it's going to be delicious. Just needs a little bit of salt. And she says, oh, yeah, I've got some salt. And then he goes, yeah, lovely. But it just needs a few carrots. And she, you know, tosses in some carrots for him. He says, yeah, great. Just needs a bit of celery and some chicken and some stock and, you know, all the rest of it. And then he serves up the soup and she says, wow, I just can't believe how delicious stone soup is. It's just, how can you make soup so delicious from some stone? And yeah, it felt like, okay, it's Rafa winning at Roland Garros, but how many of those ingredients are actually the Roland Garros ingredients that usually make Rafael Nadal so great? It feels like all of them were taken away pretty much, apart from the concrete of the Philippe Chatrier Stadium and the clay beneath his feet. Everything else was turned on its head. And he still won the thing without dropping a set, without even facing a set point. Now I don't think the stone soup analogy works at all, does it? Have I just bored people with the weirdest story ever?
No, I like it because in the end, he's so good that he can, even though all those bits have been taken away, he still pulls it off.
Yeah, although the stone soup story is actually about things being put in. Thanks, David, for trying to help me there. Anyway, I hope you all enjoyed the story and have learned something. Matt, you were saying?
I guess I've always thought of Nadal and Roland Garros as a kind of marriage of the perfect player for the perfect conditions. And this edition has shown me that actually maybe it's just the perfect player. And it's all from Nadal, because you can, as you said, you can change the month, you can change the balls, you can change the temperature, you can put a roof on it. Nadal still wins. He's still the guy. I still don't think he's been beaten at that venue when he's been fit. I think in 2015 he was well below his best the whole year, and Djokovic crushed him. And in 2009, Söderling played a brilliant match, but Rafael Nadal was clearly not right. He had knee trouble and he pulled out of Wimbledon just a month later. When he plays his best, he wins. And yes, there is something about the venue. I think the court helps him. The way he can stand so far back is an advantage that he has on that court that he maybe doesn't have on other clay courts. And the five sets help him for sure. But basically it's just because he is so great and so extraordinary. And I cannot think of an achievement in tennis or really in sport that, I'm sure there are some, but for me, it's the greatest tennis achievement, Nadal's continued dominance at Roland Garros. I mean, Chris Clary, I think, tweeted, you know, this is a record that will last for eternity. It is that good.
Yeah, I'm wary of the hyperbole of this is one of, if not the greatest achievement in sport. However, it's rare with sporting achievements that you feel comfortable saying definitively this will never be matched, because you're just opening yourself up to looking a fool at some stage in the future, because sport is all about the unexpected and the astounding and you know, never say never. But I think pretty much all commentators, Mary said it the other day, forecasting his win today, that 13 Roland Garroses will never be matched. It just won't be. 13 and counting, PS, will never be matched. So that has to put it in the conversation for greatest sporting achievement for me.
The only way I could suggest that it might be caught is that if the trajectory of player careers continues lengthening and players end up being able to play, just because of sports science, way, way longer, and somebody comes along with Nadal-like talent. That's the only thing I can think of, but I think we could be waiting way, way past our lifetimes anyway for that. And by the way, I still think we can make this stone soup thing work. All we need to do is have the vegetables and stuff and the stock and all that taken out, and it still be just as good, Catherine, don't we? If we do that...
It's literally the opposite of the stone soup
everything
story.
Everything you said.
Yeah. Opposite.
But it still works now. But, you know, we can still use it. We just need to turn it completely on its head.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Cool.
What I said, but, you know, the opposite.
Look, it's only us three. Nobody else is listening.
Yeah. This is what you'll be paying for your money for in December, folks.
quick analysis. Tell
this.
The Northern Light story quickly.
I guess just what I would want to say on Nadal, and I agree, I've got caught in the trap of getting swept up with hyperbole. I warned you that could happen, but I do.
No, I was pushing the hyperbole along.
What I think is that there are absolutely no asterisks at all related to it, because it's come in the era that we're defining as the greatest in men's tennis, and it's an individual achievement. This has all been done by Nadal, and I think that's what makes it so incredible. You can look at dynasties of teams, but that's involved several other players. But this is just a singular individual achievement over a lengthy period of time. It sort of ticks all the boxes.
So what now for the Grand Slam race?
What are you looking at me for?
I can't take my eyes off you, David, because it now looks like you're broadcasting
really
from a cupboard.
I am in the dark. I mean, it does look like a horror movie, you're right, actually. It does look like the Blair Witch Project, you're right.
Yeah.
Look, I would make Djokovic the favourite for the Australian Open, because Djokovic wins the Australian Open. That's just what happens. He's not far off as dominant there as Nadal is at the French. There's absolutely no certainty about any of these things other than Nadal's going to win the French Open as long as he's fit, most likely. Who's the favourite right now to finish with the most? I would probably say Nadal.
Yeah, I think so, because I think he's a very strong favourite to get to 21, and that requires Djokovic winning five more to overtake him, and that's possible, but it's a big ask. It's a lot of slams.
Yeah. You're assuming that he doesn't get injured, which he may not, but he may.
And looking at it in the terms that you put it yesterday, Matt, looking in terms of time, Djokovic is 33 currently, right? I mean, five slams is kind of, even if he remains dominant, most likely three seasons worth of slam winning, isn't it? Okay, he could have a season of winning three. It's not unthinkable still. But let's say he wins two a year for the next couple of years. He still has to continue doing that into 2023, assuming that Nadal wins next year's French Open at minimum. So, yeah, I'd say Nadal. And, of course, Nadal's got the Olympic gold as well.
We don't need to worry about tiebreaks until the 2020, etc.
Do you think there will be a no? Probably, because I would love it if there were, just for a moment in time, all three of them on the same.
That would be amazing.
But it feels unlikely, doesn't it? Because Nadal probably will reach 21 next year. What if Federer did a 2017 and won the Australian? Nadal wins the French, then they're both on 21.
Djokovic wins the next two.
So he's on 19.
And then he wins the Australian Open to get to 20. But then we're back at Roland Garros again. Mind you, the order of slams is
It's
no longer to be
now.
Taken for granted. Yeah.
Yes, Wimbledon could announce that it's happening in January. let's not make any more predictions for what on earth will be happening in 2021. Determined to make that road trip happen. That's all want to predict.
Oh, we're doing that. Yeah, one day. Yeah, I mean, I've got about 3 out of 28 predictions right this fortnight.
Yes, none of us got any points today, did we? But we know who the winners were.
Yep.
I'm pushing for the graph to be published, by the way, folks, because it's a...
Yes, I'm now
really
pushing
good...
for that as well, because I'm now also in the positive.
What else is on the agenda?
I don't think anything, because that's the end of the tournament, David. There's nothing to look ahead to other than a bleak black abyss. Much like your backdrop at the moment.
Yeah.
There, I mean, we
don't have lights,
worry, folks,
David, at the BBC. This is what I'm confused by.
No, we do, but I didn't think I needed them at the start of the podcast, and midway I couldn't really stop and go over and turn them on. So, you know, and now I'm quite into this sort of look.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your teeth look gleaming white because you're smiling so much. They're really jumping out of the darkness.
Yes, it's like Ross in Friends.
There's nothing to look ahead to. There will still be more weekly podcasts, don't worry. There's obviously the ATP Finals in November at the O2, events building up to that as well. There's a couple of more events on the WTA Tour. Unfortunately, only Ostrava and Linz scheduled at the moment. So we'll be covering all of the remaining tennis. We're going to be having planning meetings in a week or two's time. We're going to be doing our live show on Zoom. That's going to be new, uncharted territory for us all. Who knows, Matt and I might plan another quiz. There's still more tennis podcasting to come. But in terms of the French Open...
Live shows on Zoom are making me very anxious.
I think it'll be less nerve-wracking, Matt, than I think so.
Easy.
Yeah.
I suppose I could just mute myself, couldn't I? Or sort of claim technological woes if it's all going badly.
Yeah, that's David's go-to. But in terms of the French Open, there's only one result we haven't talked about. That is Tamir Babos and Kristina Mladenovic, the second seeds, winning the women's doubles title 6-4, 7-5 over Gorachi and Kravchik. Imagine that felt really good for them because, of course, they were withdrawn from the US Open where they were the top seeds due to Kristina Mladenovic's quarantine situation. Yeah. So
To be fair, Mladenovic, I know she caused some of her own issues or made a lot of noise around that time, but she went through a pretty tricky time being in quarantine. And then obviously she had that first round in the singles here where she was 5-1 up and there's the double bounce and suddenly it went running away from her. She's a heck of a doubles player. I mean, those two, what a partnership they've turned into.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. They sure are. So that's it for the 2020 French Open. That's it for Grand Slam tennis this year. We'll find something to relive at some stage soon, don't you worry. And the Australian Open is is going ahead. They're creating these very fun sounding quarantine bubbles for tennis players that sound like sort of theme parks, not available to journalists, unfortunately, but we'll be covering it. Don't you worry. We'll be doing daily podcasts on the Australian Open. I presume Matt will be in a caravan. but that's it for Grand Slams in 2020. How do we feel about that? Literal doom and gloom for David.
Well, yes, I mean, I am now in the pitch black. I can't see anything. But anyway.
We can't see you, David.
It kind of sums everything up, really, for the year, doesn't it? And yet we're still talking even from the gloom. That's the tennis podcast for you. Yeah, five Grand Slams worth of podcasts we've done in a year when we only had, how many? Three? I enjoyed that element.
125 pods and counting. Our all-time record is 130, which was last year. So we're going to beat that comfortably in a pandemic year. Thanks, David.
Could I just make a mention of Andy Lapthorne as well, just before we finish?
You can.
Because after his defeat in the quad singles yesterday to Dylan Alcott, he revealed that he was going to take a break from tennis because of mental health issues. There's a story on the BBC Sport website which quotes him as saying it'll be his last match for a while. He said, if I'm honest, it was really difficult to get out of bed this morning and to put myself in the position I did today, going onto a court under high pressure live on TV against probably the best player that's ever played in our division was really tough. I've probably been in a bit of denial as to what it actually is and what it was. I just want to wish him the very best and, you know, to take his time and to get well soon. Thinking of him.
Absolutely. Yep. Well said. And the same goes for Cam and Steve and Joe. You have been so wonderfully supportive of the podcast. Cam has been an absolutely immense and joyful addition to our coverage over the last couple of weeks. That email you sent us today, Steve, it means the world to us. And I'm so glad that Cam has been able to enjoy the French Open 2020. So thank you. Thank you, David and Matt. Thank you for everyone that's sent us lovely notes. They really do mean a lot to us. And we will we'll try and respond to all of them because we read all of them. And they all mean a great deal. And we'll be back in a week.
Can't wait. I'm pumped.
David Law in a permanent state of pumped. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Leave us an iTunes review. Request a reminder about our Kickstarter if you want to. It starts on December the 1st. And we will be coming to you soon, in a week's time, in fact, with our next tennis podcast. For now, though, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.